welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Endocrinology. In this podcast, three experts from the multidisciplinary team discuss how to best predict progression and prognosis in autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease, or ADPKD, and review available and emerging disease-modifying treatments for rapidly progressive ADPKD, and how to best manage potential side effects. The discussion is guided by pre-canvassed questions provided by healthcare professionals involved in the management of patients with ADPKD. This activity is funded by an independent medical education grant from Otsuka America Pharmaceutical Inc. This activity is jointly provided by USF Health and Touch IME.
Hello, my name is Brad Erickson, and I'm a consultant and professor of radiology at the Mayo Clinic of Medicine in Rochester, Minnesota in the USA. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this discussion on the key considerations for clinical management of rapidly progressing ADPKD. I'm here with Professor Neera Dahl, professor of medicine in the section of nephrology at Yale University, New Haven, Connecticut in the USA. And she is also the director of the PKD Foundation's Center of Excellence at Yale. And I'm joined by Professor Charles Vega, a clinical professor of family medicine at UC Irvine, Department of Family Medicine, Santa Ana, California, in the USA. Today, we're going to address three main questions. How can we best predict progression and prognosis in ADPKD? What is the best practice for the management of rapidly progressive ADPKD? And how can we manage the side effects of V2RAs in daily practice? You'll hear a number of questions raised along the way, and these questions are based on a pre-canvas survey of a number of providers who face these questions when they deal with patients with ADPKD. So let's address that first point. How can we best predict progression and prognosis in ADPKD? A little bit of background on the disease. ADPKD is caused by mutations primarily in the PKD1 or PKD2 gene, which encode for polycystin 1 or polycystin 2, respectively. PKD mutations result in more severe phenotype than PKD2 and account for about 80% of patients. In terms of the pathophysiology, PC1 and PC2, polycystin 1 and 2, regulate calcium signaling in renal tubular epithelia. The dysregulated calcium signaling then activates PKA and increases cyclic AMP levels, which in turn affects other signaling pathways. This leads to impaired tubulogenesis, cellular proliferation, increased fluid secretion, and interstitial inflammation, ultimately leading to fluid-filled cyst formation. Patients typically will present with early onset hypertension, abdominal fullness or pain, hematuria, cyst infection, kidney stones, urinary tract infections, or renal insufficiency. The mechanism of progression in ADPKD is that the cysts trigger an immune response causing kidney inflammation and fibrosis, leading to new cyst formation, kidney growth, and ultimately a decrease in GFR. The rate of disease progression is highly variable, but ultimately can result in end-stage renal disease. There is no global consensus on the definition of rapidly progressive ADPKD. The important prognostic biomarkers include the estimated GFR, as well as height-adjusted total kidney volume. And so, ascertaining the rate of disease progression in ADPKD is critical to the optimal management of these patients. I'm going to now engage my panel on addressing some of the important questions, and probably the place to start is to figure out how can we diagnose this disease early in order to allow for the optimal potential care. And maybe I'll point to you, Chuck, first as a primary care physician.
Right. Yeah, that is my job. My job is a sentinel out there to look for patients with some of those warning symptoms or signs. And so these are early onset hypertension, a host of different urological complaints, such as hematuria or recurrent kidney stones. And also think very strongly about a family history. So remember, this is a monogenic illness. And so, and it's not uncommon. Estimations of about 1 in 1,000 individuals are affected by ADPKD. So this is something that we are going to see during your career as a primary care clinician. It's not going to be every day you see a patient with ADPKD, but you will see them. And the key is look for those symptoms and signs, ask about a family history, and then all of those issues require some kind of renal imaging. So we're gonna send them over to you, Brad. And it could be an ultrasound or a CT, but get some kind of renal imaging. And the critical thing here is it is in a somewhat insidious onset, but the sooner you get patients referred into a center where they can be evaluated for the risk of progression and then move on to treatment, the outcomes are much better.
Excellent, thank you. Let's talk about what the risk factors are for specifically rapidly progressing ADPKD. And Neera, when you see these patients, are there signals that make you think, ooh, this is a high risk patient, somebody that I need to pay more attention to?
Yes, thank you. So when the patient is first diagnosed, so if that's something that Chuck has done by ordering the imaging, when I'm seeing the patient, the first thing I'm determining is what are their risk factors for progression. So usually that's done by looking at the imaging and determining height and age-adjusted total kidney volume. The other way of looking at progression is by asking some pertinent questions. So was there a urologic event before the age of 35? Was there development of hypertension before the age of 35? Is there a family history of early onset end-stage kidney disease? So did someone in the family develop end-stage kidney disease before the age of 55? All of those questions are very, very helpful in helping us determine prognosis. So if any of those were true, and if the patient is male, that also increases risk of prognosis. So as we're seeing the patient in that initial visit, we're trying to determine what their risk of prognosis is. And sometimes after that initial assessment, which is looking at imaging, looking at clinical features, we'll look at some of the other features as well. Do they have proteinuria that can increase risk of progression? Do they have a genotype that is associated with a higher risk of progression? We may talk about those things as well.
Neera, what are some of your thoughts on the tools for identifying the prognosis in these patients?
There are two major risk classification systems. The first is the Mayo Imaging Classification, which is a way of looking at total kidney volume adjusted for the patient's height and adjusted for the patient's age. And that, I think, most of us really like because it puts the genetic information in the context of the patient. So we know that there are other things that are important for cyst growth. For example, certain environmental factors, other genetic modifying factors. And the total kidney volume seems to represent all of those things fairly well. The other score is the ProPKD score, and this uses a combination of genotype, so a truncating PKD1 mutation being more severe than a non-truncating PKD1 mutation, being more severe than a PKD2 mutation, and then adding in a couple clinical features, sex, either male or female, and then whether there was hypertension before the age of 35, whether there was a urologic event before the age of 35. So it obviously is of somewhat limited value for a patient younger than the age of 35. And what we're learning is that it's important not to take genotype out of context. Genotype has to be considered in the context of what the kidneys look like, because some people with a fairly severe genotype, such as a truncating PKD1 mutation, may not have severe disease in terms of having a lot of cysts in their kidneys. And so really, I think both of them give separate and unique information, but we still are very much focused on looking at the kidneys before we, for the ultimate decision-making.
I would make a quick note about the Mayo Imaging Classification System. It works well for what is called class one patients. And this is where you have typical findings, bilateral disease, fairly symmetrical involvement, where it's fairly diffuse and equal. Anytime you have an atypical distribution of cysts where they're only in one kidney or just in the upper pole or something like that, then the Mayo classification system is not so reliable. And that's where it may be valuable to use more advanced imaging. My lab in particular is focused on using tools and MRI to get very precise measurements of total kidney volume in a fully automated fashion. And these are tools that we probably will start to see roll out into clinical practice in the near future. I think also in terms of looking at the risk, we've done some early work that probably isn't ready for clinical prime time yet, but suggesting that kidneys with many small cysts probably progress more rapidly than people who have a few large cysts, even when the volume is the same. And that kind of makes sense knowing about the disease. Another important question is discussing how frequently should patients at risk of progressive disease be monitored? Thoughts on that?
I'll take that question. We typically get an imaging early on to assess risk of progression and to give the patients a prognostic timeline. After that, I think we get imaging based on symptoms. So if someone is having pain or hematuria, there might be a reason to get more imaging. If someone is in the middle of a risk classification level, so between Mayo imaging class 1B and 1C, for example, where it may matter in terms of whether or not they're appropriate for therapy, then after maybe 2 to 3 years, we would repeat imaging and get another total kidney volume to see if they're staying true to their Mayo imaging class or whether they've moved to a different Mayo imaging class. And Brad, you may know this data better than I do, but I think it's about 10 to 12% of patients may change from one class to another. So that would be a reason to consider re-imaging someone after that first prognostic image is made.
Excellent. You know, we have three very different specialties here, and some people may wonder why a radiologist is moderating this panel, but I think it emphasizes the point of a multidisciplinary team. And Chuck, you're kind of the quarterback of the team because you're seeing these patients every day. How do you think about a multidisciplinary team and how you best manage patients with ADPKD?
We are going to be in primary care following the patients routinely, making sure that their hypertension is managed, that they're getting good nutrition, good hydration, any other chronic illnesses that come up, and of course, preventive care with things like vaccinations. But, you know, I really do depend on radiology, nephrology to be in communication as well regarding the risk for progression of illness and treatment options that are directed at ADPKD specifically, which we're going to talk about shortly in another module. And just reaching out as with somebody to talk to for cases that go awry when you know, patients may notice more symptoms and or laboratory values that look like they are not being stable anymore. Reaching out directly is always a big thing to do and can really be impactful for patients.
Thank you for your insights. Now we address the question of what is the best practice for managing rapidly progressive ADPKD? In terms of pharmacologic treatments for rapidly progressing ADPKD, the only currently approved drug is tolvaptan. There are some investigational agents, including metformin XR, octreotide, lanreotide, octreotide with tolvaptan, and the list goes on. There are also important drugs for the management of hypertension that can be seen in patients with ADPKD, and typically the first-line agents there are ACE inhibitors. There were three important clinical trials of tolvaptan. The TEMPO-3-4 trial looked at the increase of total kidney volume as well as serum creatinine measures. And what they found there is that tolvaptan slowed the increase in TKV and also the decline in kidney function. TEMPO-4-4 also looked at the rate of TKV increase as well as the change in eGFR. And they found that tolvaptan had a sustained disease-modifying effect on eGFR but not on TKV. And then finally, we have the REPRISE trial. And there they measured the change in EGFR as well as the slope of change in EGFR. And what they found is that tolvaptan slowed the decline in EGFR. There are some emerging treatments now. They're a little bit earlier on. They're in phase 2-3 state. Lanreotide is one. Octreotide, LAR, is another one. And then the combination of tolvaptan along with octreotide, LAR. And you can see they're using similar measurements, looking at things like the total kidney volume as well as renal function. And these certainly do look very promising. So let's discuss now, first of all, recognizing that there are now one approved effective treatment for ADPKD, we need to think about how we should decide which patients are eligible for treatment in clinical practice, particularly given that there's no consensus definition of rapidly progressive disease. Any thoughts about that?
Well, I think that it's just important for us in the primary care community to know that there is a treatment that's approved or it's directed for ADPKD. So if your patient has not seen a nephrologist lately, if they've been, especially if they've had evidence of disease progression, either through radiographic finding symptoms or laboratory results, it's a good time to get them reevaluated because they may very well qualify for a treatment like tolvaptan.
Neera, how do you think about identifying patients that should or shouldn't go on tolvaptan?
For clinicians who are trying to determine whether a patient is at risk of rapidly progressing ADPKD, there is guidance in the literature. Both there are American U.S. consensus statement guidelines and European consensus statement guidelines. There will be new information coming from KDIGO later in 2023. Discussing all of this in detail. From our point of view, we're looking at patients early on in terms of their risk of progression, or we're looking at patients who have already progressed. So in the United States, the main way of determining eligibility for tolvaptan is looking at Mayo imaging classification. So those patients who are Mayo 1C, 1D, or 1E are eligible for treatment if their GFR is greater than about 25 mils per minute. The nice thing about the European consensus guidelines is that they also look at those patients who are already progressing. So those patients who have had rapid decline in GFR that's associated with ADPKD, not associated, for instance, with glomerulonephritis or with diabetes, those patients are also eligible for treatment. And really what we're trying to do is find those patients who are most likely to benefit from tolvaptan therapy, those patients who are rapidly progressing, either by a prognostic indicator such as a high ProPKD score or high Mayo imaging classification, or by evidence of rapid progression.
What would you say would be a starting point for the frequency at which you monitor patients? And then what are some factors that might cause you to monitor patients more frequently or less frequently?
Before we start tolvaptan therapy, we're monitoring the patients based on what their GFR is. So someone who has relatively well-preserved GFR, we may not be seeing them as frequently as someone who's developing stage 3 kidney disease or more advanced kidney disease. Once they're on tolvaptan therapy, there's very specific guidelines in the U.S. for how frequently those patients should be monitored, and we'll review some of that in the next module. I think the other thing to remember is that all of the patients do get discussion regarding management of the blood pressure, as you mentioned, but also dietary management, following a low-salt diet, following a diet that's a heart-healthy diet, maintaining an ideal body weight, because we know all of those things affect progression as well. And that is part of the discussion that happens with us and with primary care in terms of managing these patients.
Excellent. And are there contraindications that you want to make sure that people don't forget when they consider using tolvaptan?
The contraindications to therapy would be, first of all, patients who cannot keep up with the fluid intake. So patients, for example, who have a colostomy or who have some other reason why they can't manage the fluid intake. Patients who have an impaired ability to sense thirst. All of those would be reasons to not be on tolvaptan therapy. Other contraindications would be people who are already on a medication that is a strong CYP3A inhibitor. Patients who are pregnant or lactating can't be on tolvaptan therapy. But really, for us, it comes down to a risk balance assessment as to whether the patient's lifestyle would be one in which supports use of tolvaptan therapy.
You know, I'm sure we will discuss this quite a bit in our next section, so please stay tuned for that. But it's also important to consider liver function before prescribing tolvaptan and patients' risks for hepatotoxicity associated with the drug. So, you know, it's very pertinent in my practice because non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, particularly in our community, is just rampant. It affects about 5% of U.S. adults. And so it's important to think about hepatic function and hepatic toxicity before initiating tolvaptan. But that does not mean that, remember that ADPKD is also associated with a higher rate of liver cyst formation. Now, just because a patient has a liver cyst doesn't necessarily mean tolvaptan is off the table. So I think that's another important point to make.
All right. You know, for many years, we had no treatment for PKD, and tolvaptan, fortunately, has been approved. But as you saw, there are now starting to be some new treatments that are being tested. Any thoughts on how some of these new disease-modifying treatments might impact the treatment landscape once they're approved?
The two best studied would be octreotide and the long-acting octreotide and then lanreotide. And those, I think, have a very interesting role because those, unlike tolvaptan, also affect liver cysts. And so patients in particular who have complications due to the liver cysts may benefit from those therapies particularly. The other therapies are still very much under investigation. And I think we're all excited that there are so many opportunities for clinical trials for patients who may not be appropriate for tolvaptan therapy or who may have tried tolvaptan and not been able to tolerate the side effects. And so it's from a treatment perspective, it's really nice to be able to offer either what's current therapy or to offer some of these newer therapies in the setting of a clinical trial.
Thank you. That's an excellent summary of what's happening in the field. Finally, we come to the important question of how to manage the side effects of V2RAs in daily practice. There are some potentially serious side effects of these drugs. These include things like dehydration, hypovolemia, hypernatremia, and that ultimately is due to aquaresis. On the other hand, you also have important liver function problems. There can be acute liver failure as well as serious hepatocellular injury, all stemming from hepatotoxicity. Looking at some of the phase 3 safety data for tolvaptan, starting with the TEMPO 3-4 study, what they found is that there were fewer ADPKD-related adverse events in tolvaptan versus placebo group, but there were more hepatic adverse events and adverse events related to aquaresis. In the TEMPO 4-4 trial, they found that the safety profile for TEMPO 4-4 was similar to the tolvaptan arm of TEMPO 3-4. And then in the REPRISE trial, they found that there were fewer ADPKD-related adverse events in tolvaptan versus the placebo group, but more hepatic adverse events and adverse events related to aquaresis. So this leads to some important questions. First of all, How can clinicians best manage the serious side effects that are associated with V2RAs, things like aquaresis and elevated liver enzymes?
So this is a really important discussion to have with patients before we start them on therapy with tolvaptan, because the typical patient will go from maybe drinking 2 liters, or if they're already doing a very good job with fluid intake, maybe 3 liters, to now drinking in the order of 5 to 6 liters. And so this can obviously have a huge impact on day-to-day work. We know that patients who have jobs where they need to be on their feet all the time may not be able to manage the aquaretic side effects in terms of the frequent urination. But what we are really recommending is that patients drink all the time, and patients on this medication like drinking, so that's not what they complain about. Usually what they complain about is having to urinate as frequently as they do, and particularly the nighttime urination. And so what we tell them is to take the first dose, which is usually the higher dose of medication, as early as possible in the day, and then take the next dose 8 hours later, so that by the time they're going to bed, the medication has worn off. We also know that protein intake, salt intake will drive aquaresis. And so we try and limit that, tell them to have a lower salt. We want everyone to be following low salt diets, but have a lower solute intake, particularly for that final meal of the day. So that's some of the information that we're advising patients. And then we're obviously telling them to beware of things that are associated with either hyponatremia, hypernatremia, or volume depletion, such as, are they getting dizzy? Are they fainting? Are they having some weight loss? So we're asking, doing a lot of follow-up in that first 2 weeks to a month to see how they're feeling on drug, how they're tolerating drug, whether we need to adjust the dose of the drug.
You know, a couple of practical points that can help patients too is trying to follow a regular diet. A DASH diet is a good model to follow, the dietary approaches to stop hypertension. But if they start doing ketogenic diets, very high protein diets, they could get into trouble. Intermittent fasting, again, could be trouble. And then I would also point out that you don't want to compound the problem. So certainly it's diuretics. Diuretics are not friends of patients with ADPKD, so really shouldn't be used. But then there's also avoid anticholinergic drugs. Drugs with anticholinergic properties are going to dry out the mouth. That's one of the most common side effects. And so therefore, patients may be taking a little bit more fluid and then having to go to the bathroom more frequently, which can be bothersome, eventually to the point where they decide they don't want to continue therapy.
Thank you. Those are excellent points. How should the tolvaptan treatment regimen be adapted in order to follow the onset of side effects? Are there cases where you'd recommend stopping tolvaptan treatment, and what would those conditions be?
Patients are most worried perhaps about the aquaretic side effects. From a management point of view, we're most worried about potential hepatotoxicity. And in the U.S., we're following a very strict REMS protocol for monitoring that hepatotoxicity. So in the U.S., we check labs at baseline at 2 weeks and then at 1 month, and then check labs every month for the first 18 months, and then every 3 months while the patient remains on drug. And it's really important before we do that, that we advise the patients what to look for in terms of what potential hepatotoxicity might be. And we're giving them this information, even though we're hoping that we will find any small abnormality in terms of LFTs well before they have symptoms. But this, the monitoring for liver injury, that might include fatigue, anorexia, pruritus, jaundice, any of those things that we associate with liver injury. In terms of monitoring the LFTs, we're looking for evidence first of an increase in ALT or AST. And if we see a rise more than 2 times normal, we may hold drug and then repeat testing. If we see a rise more than 3 times normal in AST or ALT, then we may discontinue the drug completely, particularly if there's no other reason that that patient has an LFT abnormality. So we have a lot of conversations around alcohol use on tolvaptan, around other drugs that could potentially cause minor LFT abnormalities before we decide whether or not a patient can stay on drug or whether or not we can retest a patient with very, very small 2 to 3-fold changes in LFTs before restarting the drug. And then, of course, if there's evidence of severe injury in terms of the LFTs, we would stop drug permanently and then not restart it.
Excellent. Thank you. So, Chuck, you mentioned some of the dietary considerations in managing the side effects. Are there other great points that you want to make about some of these other potentially the liver effects, for instance?
Well, I think Nir did a great job talking about just practical aspects of diet and fluid intake, and then also liver monitoring. In the clinical trials, it was noted that when patients did have elevations of their hepatic enzymes, when they discontinued drug, generally those numbers fell back to normal. And also, yeah, it's everything is a balance between benefits and risks. And remember in the tolvaptan trials as well, that I think it's really important that certainly, while aquapheresis side effects and liver side effects were more prominent in the active treatment group, renal side effects, including very important things to patients, such as kidney pain, such as UTIs, were more common in the placebo group. So I think that it's important to strike that balance as well. And it does take some dedication on the part of patients to really tolerate tolvaptan, to come in for the fairly frequent lab monitoring. Many times they're used to getting frequent lab monitoring because they have significant hypertension and ADPKD. But I think that before initiating treatment, it's best to go over what to expect. And that way, setting expectations is the right way to set up patients up for success with this drug.
For patients who are not tolerating the dose that they're on currently, so typically we start at a dose of 4515, which was the lowest starting dose in the clinical trials, and then work up to 6030 or 9030. If a patient can't tolerate 4515 in clinical practice, we'll then go to 3015 or sometimes even to 1515. What we do not recommend at all, though, is going to once daily dosing. This drug needs to be given twice a day because we want really effective vasopressin blockade throughout the day. So it's important to decrease both doses rather than to go to just once daily dosing. And then the other thing that may be beneficial in determining how to dose and how to find that balance of tolerable dose is by measuring fasting urine osmolarity. So there's some data to suggest that if you can keep that fasting urine osmolarity below 280, then you've hit the right dose. The other thing to remember is that patients have the hardest time with drug on the first few months to year that they're taking the medication. After a while, people sort of reset and have a new lifestyle that allows for use of the drug. So we know that as we follow patients, they tend to report fewer side effects the longer that they're on the drug. The final bit of information we tell patients. So in our practice, we see patients at that 1 month mark to assess tolerability. But at every visit while they're on tolvaptan, we review a few things. The first is if they are prescribed a new drug to let us know about it, because we really are very interested in making sure that there aren't specific drug-drug side effects. And so that's really critical for us, because otherwise they may inadvertently have a higher or lower dose of tolvaptan while they're on that other drug. The most common offender for us is antibiotics such as azithromycin or clarithromycin. The next is that if the patient does not have access to fluid that day, they're traveling on a plane or they're going to be doing something where they really can't drink every hour or so, then we tell them not to take the medication on that day. If they're going in for surgery, we tell them to hold the medication during that time period. For some of our patients who've been very ill with COVID, we've been telling them while they're sick not to take the drug. We want this treatment to be a lifelong therapy over years and years, but we want them to be successful on the therapy. So if they're having a sick day, if they're vomiting, having diarrhea, if there's some other reason that they may have fluid loss, then they shouldn't be taking this medication.
Thank you, Neera. Those are wonderful insights into how to take care of our patients. I want to say thank you to you, the audience, for watching. I hope it's been useful to you. I also want to say thank you to Professors Dahl and Vega for joining in this discussion on the key considerations of the clinical management of rapidly progressing AD-PKD. Your insights into this disease and how to manage the treatment is extremely valuable. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on this and related topics on Touch Endocrinology at www.touchendocrinology.com.